Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Marissa is going to introduce Nam Lee. I'm going to have the pleasure of introducing her. Marissa Silver has a background in filmmaking. Her first feature film, Old Enough, won the top prize at the Sundance Film Festival, and after that she went on to direct three more feature films, Permanent Record, Vital Signs, and He Said, She Said. She made her fictional debut in The New Yorker, where she was featured in that magazine's debut fiction issue. Her collection of short stories, Babe in Paradise, was published by Norton in 2001 and named a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a Los Angeles Times Best Book of the Year. In 2005, she published her novel No Direction Home, and her latest novel, The God of War, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Fiction. I'm sure many of you here have read it. It's a beautiful book. It's been anthologized in the Best Her fiction has been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories and the O. Henry Prize Stories. In the LA Times Book Review, James Gibbon wrote of The God of War, a moving exploration of fraying family bonds, deftly balanced with an elegiac parable, one whose desert backdrop lends resonance to Silver's ruminations on the mysteries of violence and loss, love and rage, guilt and blame. A pleasure to welcome Marissa Silver. Thank you.
Hi. Good? Everybody can hear? Thank you so much for that introduction. I am so pleased to introduce Nam Lee to you this evening. Nam's first collection of fiction, The Boat, was published in this country in May 2008 to rapturous reviews. Michiko Kakutani, writing in the New York Times, said, "Mr. Lee not only writes with an authority and poise rare even among longtime authors, but he also demonstrates an intuitive, gut-level ability to convey the psychological conflicts people experience when they find their own hopes and ambitions slamming up against familial expectations or the brute facts of history. The opening story is a singular masterpiece. Lee's sympathy for his characters and his ability to write with both lyricism and emotional urgency lend his portraits enormous visceral power." In the Los Angeles Times, Antoine Wilson noted that the opening story of the collection, in its complexity, in its range, in its depiction of a struggle to make sense of experience, achieves the realm of literature. Lee's stories have received numerous prizes, including the award for Newcomer of the Year from the Australian book industry, the NSW Premier Literary Award for Book of the Year, and most recently, the prize for Australian Short Story Collection in the Queensland Premier's Literary Award. I'm pleased to introduce to you Nam Lee.
Hello. Thank you so much, Marissa, for that introduction. Thank you all for coming. I'm very thrilled to be here as part of Louise's Allowed series, which is such an incredible series and an honour to be included in that company. And I'm also extraordinarily thrilled to be here with Marissa and to have this moment with her. I just finished reading her book on the plane flying from Pittsburgh to LA. And I think my companion next to me was very, very interested and couldn't decide whether to read the words on the page or look at my face, which was going through all of the various emotional contortions. It's an incredible book, you should definitely read it. I'm going to read a bit from, it's about the first third from the first story in The Boat. The story is called Love and Honour and Pity and Pride and Compassion and Sacrifice. This will probably go for about 15, 16 minutes. My father arrived on a rainy morning. I was dreaming about a poem, the dull thluck, thluck of a typewriter's keys punching out the letters. It was a good poem, perhaps the best I'd ever written. When I woke up, he was standing outside my bedroom door, smiling ambiguously. He wore black trousers and a wet, wrinkled parachute jacket that looked like it had just been pulled out of a washing machine. Framed by the bedroom doorway, he appeared even smaller, gaunter than I remembered. Still groggy with dream, I lifted my face toward the alarm clock. "What time is it?" "Hello, son," he said in Vietnamese. I knocked for a long time. Then the door just opened. "The fields are glass," I thought. Then tum titi, a dactyl, end line, then the words excuse and alloy in the line after. "Come on," I thought. "It's raining heavily," he said. I frowned. The clock read 11:44. "I thought you weren't coming until this afternoon." It felt strange, after all this time, to be speaking Vietnamese again. "They changed my flight in Los Angeles."
"Why didn't you ring?"
"I tried," he said equably. "No answer." I twisted over the side of the bed and cracked open the window. The sound of rain filled the room. Rain fell on the streets, on the roofs, on the tin shed across the parking lot like the distant detonation of firecrackers. Everything smelled of wet leaves. "I turn the ringer off when I sleep," I said. "Sorry." He continued smiling at me, significantly, as if waiting for an announcement. I was dreaming. He used to wake me when I was young by standing over me and smacking my cheeks lightly. I hated it, the wetness, the sourness of his hands. "Come on," he said, picking up a large Adidas duffel and a rolled bundle that looked like a sleeping bag. A day lived, a sea of knowledge earned. He had a habit of speaking in Vietnamese proverbs. I had long since learned to ignore it. I threw on a t-shirt and stretched my neck in front of the lone window. Through the rain, the sky was as grey and striated as graphite. The fields, a glass. Like a shape in smoke, the poem blurred, then dissolved into this new, cold, strange reality. A wind-blown, rain-strafed parking lot. A dark room almost entirely taken up by my bed. The small body of my father dripping water onto hardwood floors. I went to him, my legs goose-pimpled underneath my pyjamas. He watched with pleasant indifference as my hand reached for his, shook it, then relieved his other hand of the bags. "You must be exhausted," I said. He'd flown from Sydney, Australia, 33 hours all up, transiting in Auckland, Los Angeles and Denver before touching down in Iowa. I hadn't seen him in 3 years. "You'll sleep in my room." "Very fancy," he said, as he led me through my own apartment. "You even have a piano." He gave me an almost rueful smile. "I knew you'd never really quit." Something moved behind his face, and I found myself back on a heightened stool with my fingers chasing the metronome, ahead and behind, trying to shut out the tutor's repeated sighing, his heavy brass ruler. I realized I was massaging my knuckles. My father patted the futon in my living room. "I'll sleep here." "You'll sleep in my room, Ma." I watched him warily as he surveyed our surroundings, messy with books, papers, dirty plates, teacups, clothes. I'd intended to tidy up before going to the airport. "I work in this room anyway, and I work at night." As he moved into the kitchen, I grabbed the 3/4 full bottle of Johnny Walker from the second shelf of my bookcase and stashed it under the desk. I looked around. The desktop was gritty with cigarette ash. I threw some magazines over the roughest spots, then flipped one of them over because its cover bore a picture of Chairman Mao. I quickly gathered up the cigarette packs and sleeping pills and incense burners and dumped them all on a high shelf behind my Kafka vintage classics. At the kitchen swing door, I remembered the photo of Linda beside the printer. Her glamour shot, I called it, hair windswept and eyes squinty, smiling at something out of frame. One of her ex-boyfriends had taken it at Lake McBride. She looked happy. I snatched it and turned it face down, covering it with scrap paper.
As I walked into the kitchen, I thought, for a moment, that I'd left the fire escape open. I could hear rainwater gushing along gutters, down through the pipes. Then I saw my father at the sink, sleeves rolled up, sponge in hand, washing the month-old crusted mound of dishes. The smell was awful. "Ah," I frowned, "you don't need to do that." His hands, hard and leathery, moved deftly in the sink. "Ah," I said half-heartedly, "I'm almost finished." He looked up and smiled. "Have you eaten? Do you want me to make you some lunch?" "Ty," I said, suddenly irritated, "you're exhausted. I'll go out and get us something." I went back through the living room into my bedroom, picking up clothes and rubbish along the way. "You don't have to worry about me," he called out. "You just do what you always do." The truth was, he'd come at the worst possible time. I was in my last year at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. It was late November, and my final story for the semester was due in 3 days. I had a backlog of papers to grade and a heap of fellowship and job applications to draft and submit. It was no wonder I was drinking so much. I'd told Linda only the previous night that he was coming. We were at her place. Her body was slippery with sweat and hard to hold. Her body smelled of her clothes. She turned me over, my face kissing the bedsheets, and then she was chopping my back with the edges of her hands. Higher, out a bit more. She had trouble keeping a steady rhythm. "Softer," I told her. Moments later, I started laughing. "What?" The sheets were damp beneath my pressed face. "What?" "Softer," I said, "not slower." She slapped my back with the meat of her palms, hard, once, twice. I couldn't stop laughing. I squirmed over and caught her by the wrists. Hunched forward, she was blushing and beautiful. Her hair fell over her face. Beneath its ash-blonde hem, all I could see were her open lips. She pressed down, into me, her shoulders kinking the long, lean curve from the back of her neck to the small of her back. "Stop it," her lips said. She rested her hands free, her fingers beneath my waistband, violent, the scratch of her nails down my thighs, knees, ankles. I pointed my foot like a ballet dancer. Afterward, I told her my father didn't know about her. She said nothing. "We just don't talk about that kind of stuff," I explained. She looked like an actress who looked like my girlfriend. Staring at her face made me tired. I'd begun to feel this way more often around her. "He's only here for 3 days," I said. Somewhere out of sight, a group of college boys hooted and yelled. "I thought you didn't talk to him at all." "He's my father. What's he want?" I rolled toward her onto my elbow. I tried to remember how much I'd told her about him. We'd been lying on the bed, the wind loud in the room, I remember that, and we were both tipsy. Ours could have been any two voices in the darkness. "It's only 3 days," I said. The look on her face was strange, shut down. She considered me a long time. Then she got up and pulled on her clothes. "Just make sure you get your story done," she said. I drank before I came here too. I drank when I was a student at university and then when I was a lawyer, in my previous life, as they say. There was a subterranean bar in a hotel next to my work, and every night I would wander down and slump on a bar stool and pretend I didn't want the bartender to make small talk. He was only a bit older than me, and I came to envy his ease, his confidence that any given situation was merely temporary. I left exorbitant tips. After a while, I was treated to battered shrimps and shepherd's pies on the house. My parents had already split by then, my father moving to Sydney, my mother into a government flat. That's all I've ever done, traffic in words. Sometimes I still think about word counts the way a general must think about casualties. I'd been in Iowa more than a year. Days passed in weeks, then months, more than a year of days, and I'd written only 3.5 stories, about 17,000 words. When I was working at the law firm, I would have written that many words in a couple of weeks, and they would have been useful to someone. Deadlines came, exhausting, and I forced myself up to meet them. Then, in the great spans of time between, I fell back to my vacant screen and my slowly sludging mind. I tried everything, writing in longhand, writing in my bed, in my bathtub. As this last deadline approached, I remembered a friend claiming he'd broken his writer's block by switching to a typewriter. "You're free to write," he told me. "Once you know, you can't delete what you've written." I bought an electric Smith Corona at an antique shop. It buzzed like a tropical aquarium when I plugged it in. It looked good on my desk. For inspiration, I read absurdly formal Victorian poetry and drank scotch neat. How hard could it be? Things happened in this world all the time. All I had to do was record them. In the sky, two swarms of swallows converged, pulled apart, interwove again like veils drifting at cross currents. In line at the supermarket, a black woman leaned forward and kissed the handle of her shopping cart, her skin dark and glossy like the polished wood of a piano. The week prior to my father's arrival, a friend chastised me for my persistent defeatism. "Writer's block." Under the streetlights, vapours of bourbon puffed out of his mouth. "How can you have writer's block? Just write a story about Vietnam." We had just come from a party following a reading by the workshop's most recent success, a Chinese woman trying to immigrate to America, who had written a book of short stories about Chinese characters in stages of immigration to America. The stories were subtle and good. The gossip was that she'd been offered a substantial 6-figure contract for a 2-book deal. It was meant to be an unspoken rule that such things were left unspoken. Of course, it was all anyone talked about. "It's hot," a writer instructor told me at a bar. "Ethnic literature's hot. And important, too." A couple of visiting literary agents took a similar view. "There's a lot of polished writing around," one of them said. "You have to ask yourself, what makes me stand out?" She tag-teamed to her colleague, who answered slowly, as though intoning a mantra, "Your background and life experience." Other friends were more forthright. "I'm sick of ethnic lit," one said. "It's full of descriptions of exotic food." Or, "You can't tell if the language is spare because the author intended it that way or because he didn't have the vocab." I was told about a friend of a friend, a Harvard graduate from Washington, D.C., who had posed in traditional Nigerian garb for his book jacket photo. I pictured myself standing in a rice paddy, wearing a straw conical hat. Then I pictured my father in the same field, wearing his threadbare fatigues, young and hard-eyed. "It's a license to bore," my friend said. We were drunk and walking our bikes because both of us, separately, had punctured our tyres on the way to the party. "The characters are always flat, generic. As long as a Chinese writer writes about Chinese people, or a Peruvian writer about Peruvians, or a Russian writer about Russians," he said, as though reciting children's doggerel, then stopped, losing his train of thought. His mouth turned up into a doubtful grin. I could tell he was angry about something. "Look," I said, pointing at a floodlit porch ahead of us. "Those guys have guns." "As long as there's an interesting image or metaphor, once in every this much text," he held out his thumb and forefinger to indicate half a page, his bike wobbling all over the sidewalk. I nodded to him, and then I nodded to one of the guys on the porch, who nodded back. The other guy waved us through with his faux wood air rifle. A car with its headlights on was idling in the driveway, and girls' voices emerged from inside, squealing, "Don't shoot! Don't shoot!" "Faulkner, you know," my friend said over the squeals. He said we should write about the old verities, love and honour, and pity and pride and compassion and sacrifice. A sudden sharp crack behind us, like the striking of a giant typewriter hammer, followed by some muffled shrieks. I know I'm a bad person for saying this, my friend said. But that's why I don't mind your work, Nam, because you could just write about Vietnamese boat people all the time, like in your third story. He must have thought my head was bowed in modesty, but in fact I was figuring out whether I'd just been shot in the back of the thigh. I'd felt a distinct sting. The pellet might have ricocheted off something. You could totally exploit the Vietnamese thing, but instead you choose to write about lesbian vampires and Colombian assassins and Hiroshima orphans and New York painters with hemorrhoids. For a dreamlike moment, I was taken aback. Catalogued like that, under the bourbon stink of his breath, my stories sank into unflattering relief. My leg was still stinging. I imagined sticking my hand down the back of my jeans, bringing it to my face under a streetlight, and finding it gory, blood-spattered. I imagined turning around, advancing wordlessly up the porch steps, and drop-kicking the two kids. I would tell my story into a microphone from a hospital bed. I would compose my story in a county cell. I would kill one of them, maybe accidentally, and never talk about it, ever, to anyone. There was no hole in my jeans. I'm probably a bad person, my friend said, stumbling beside his bike a few steps ahead of me. If you ask me why I came to Iowa, I would say that Iowa is beautiful, in the way that any place is beautiful, if you treat it as the answer to a question you're asking yourself every day just by being there. That afternoon, as I was leaving the apartment for Linda's, my father called out my name from the bedroom. I stopped outside the closed door. He was meant to be napping. "Where are you going?" his voice said. "For a walk," I replied. "I'll walk with you." It always struck me how everything seemed larger in scale on Summit Street. The double-storied houses, their smooth lawns sloping down to the sidewalks like golf greens, elm trees with high, thick branches, the sort of branches from which I imagined fathers suspending long-roped swings for daughters in white dresses. The leaves, once golden and red, were turning brown, dark orange. The rain had stopped. I don't know why, but we walked in the middle of the road, dark asphalt gleaming beneath the slick, pasted leaves like the back of a whale. I asked him, "What do you want to do while you're here?" His face was pale and fixed in a smile. "Don't worry about me," he said. "I can just meditate or read." "There's a coffee shop downtown," I said, "and a Japanese restaurant." It sounded pathetic. It occurred to me that I knew nothing about what my father did all day. He kept smiling, looking at the ground moving in front of his feet. "I have to write," I said. "You write." And I could no longer read his smile. He had perfected it during our separation. It was a setting of the lips, sly, almost imperceptible, which I would probably have taken for a sign of senility but for the keenness of his eyes. "There's an art museum across the river," I said. "Ah, take me there." "The museum?" "No," he said, looking sideways at me. "The river." We turned back to Burlington Street and walked down the hill to the river. He stopped halfway across the bridge. The water below looked cold and black, slowing in sections as it succumbed to the temperature. Behind us, six lanes of cars skidded back and forth across the wet grit of the road, the sound like the shredding of wind. "Have you heard from your mother?" He stood upright before the railing, his head strangely small above the puffy down jacket I had lent him. "Every now and then." He lapsed into formal Vietnamese. "How is the mother of Nam?" "She is good," I said, too loudly, trying to make myself heard over the groans and clanks of a passing truck. He was nodding. Behind him, the east bank of the river glowed wanly in the afternoon light. "Come on," I said. We crossed the bridge and walked to a nearby Dairy Queen. When I came out, two coffees in my hand, my father had gone down to the river's edge. Next to him, a bundled-up, bearded figure stooped over a burning gasoline drum. Never had I seen anything like it in Iowa City. "This is my son," my father said, once I had scrambled down the wet bank. "The writer." I glanced quickly at him, but his face gave nothing away. He lifted a hot paper cup out of my hand. "Would you like some coffee?" "Thank you, no." The man stood still, watching his knotted hands, palms glowing orange above the rim of the drum. His voice was soft, his clothes heavy with his life. I smelled animals in him, and fuel, and rain. "I read his story," my father went on in his lilting English, "about Vietnamese boat people." He gazed at the man, straight into his blank, rheumy eyes, then said, as though delivering a punchline, "We are Vietnamese boat people." We stood there for a long time, the three of us, watching the flames. When I lifted my eyes, it was dark. "Do you have any money on you?" my father asked me in Vietnamese. "Welcome to America," the man said through his beard. He didn't look up as I closed his fist around the damp bills. My father was drawn to weakness, even as he tolerated none in me. "He was a soldier," he said once, as if that explained everything. With me, he was all proverbs and regulations. No personal phone calls, no female friends, no extracurricular reading. When I was in primary school, he made me draw up a daily 10-hour study timetable for the summer holidays and punished me when I deviated from it. He knew how to cane me 20 times and leave only one black-red welt, like a brand mark, across my buttocks. Afterward, as he rubbed tiger balm on the wound, I would cry in anger at myself for crying. Once, when my mother let slip that durian fruit made me vomit, he forced me to eat it in front of guests. Rai ang mui kum ngong. Hunger finds no fault with food. I learned to hate him with a straight face. When I was 14, I discovered that he had been involved in a massacre. Later, I would come across photos and transcripts and books, but that night, at a family friend's party in suburban Melbourne, it was just another story in a circle of drunken men. They sat cross-legged on newspapers around a large blue tarpaulin, getting smashed on cheap beer. It was that time of night when things started to break up against other things. Red faces, raised voices, spilled drinks. We arrived late, and the men shuffled around, making room for my father. "Tun, fuck your mother. What took you so long? Scared? No? Sit down, sit down. Give him 5 bottles. The speaker swung around ferociously. "We're letting you off easy. Everyone here's had 8, 9 already." For the first time, my father let me stay. I sat on the perimeter of the circle, watching in fascination. A thicket of Vietnamese voices, cursing, toasting, braying about their children, making fun of one man who kept stuttering, "It has the power of 500 horses." Through it all, my father laughed good-naturedly, his face so red with drink he looked sunburned. Bowl and chopsticks in his hands, he appeared somewhat childish, squashed between two men trading war stories. I watched him as he picked sparingly at the enormous spread of dishes in the middle of the circle. The food was known as Đồ Nhậu, alcohol food. Massive fatty oysters dipped in salt pepper lemon paste. Boiled sea snails the size of pool balls. Southern-style shredded chicken salad, soaked in vinegar, and eaten with spotty brown rice crackers. Someone called out my father's name. He had set his chopsticks down and was speaking in a low voice. Heavens, the gunships came first, rockets and M-60s. You remember that sound, no? like you were deaf. We were hiding in the bunker underneath the temple, my mother and four sisters and Mrs. Tran, the baker, and some other people. You couldn't hear anything. Then the gunfire stopped, and Mrs. Tran told my mother we had to go up to the street. If we stayed there, the Americans would think we were Viet Cong. I'm not going anywhere, my mother said. They have grenades, Mrs. Tran said. I was scared and excited. I had never seen an American before. It took me a while to reconcile my father with the story he was telling. He caught my eye and held it a moment, as though he were sharing a secret with me. He was drunk. So we went up. Everywhere there was dust and smoke, and all you could hear was a sound of helicopters and M-16s. Houses on fire. Then, through the smoke, I saw an American. I almost laughed. He wore his uniform so untidily, it was too big for him, and he had a beaded necklace and a baseball cap. He held an M-16 over his shoulder like a spade. Heavens, he looked nothing like the Viet Cong, with their shirts buttoned up to their chins and tucked in, even after crawling through mud tunnels all day. He picked up his chopsticks and reached for the dick gun, a specialty, mincemeat soaked in fresh, congealed duck blood. Some of the other men were listening now, smiling knowingly. I saw his teeth stained red as he chewed through the rest of his words. They made us walk to the east side of the village. There were about 10 of them, about 50 of us. Mrs. Tran was saying, "No VC, no VC." They didn't hear her, not over the sound of machine guns and the M79 grenade launches. Remember those? Only I heard her. I saw pieces of animals all over the paddy fields, a water buffalo with its side missing, like it was scooped out by a spoon. Then, through the smoke, I saw Grandpa Long bowing to a GI in the traditional greeting. I wanted to call out to him. His wife and daughter and granddaughters, me and Gim, stood shyly behind him. The GI stepped forward, tapped the top of his head with the rifle butt, and then twirled the gun around and slid the bayonet to his throat. No one said anything. My mother tried to cover my eyes, but I saw him switch the fire selector on his gun from automatic to single shot before he shot Grandma Long. Then he and a friend pulled the daughter into a shack, the two little girls dragged along, clinging to her legs. They stopped us at the drainage ditch near the bridge. There were bodies on the road, a baby with only the bottom half of its head, a monk, his robe turning pink. I saw two bodies with the ace of spades carved into the chests. I didn't understand it. My sisters didn't even cry. People were now shouting, "No VC, no VC," but the Americans just frowned and spat and laughed. One of them said something. Then some of them started pushing us into the ditch. It was half full of muddy water. My mother jumped in and lifted my sisters down, one by one. I remember looking up and seeing helicopters everywhere, some bigger than others, some higher up. They made us kneel in the water. They set up their guns on tripods. They made us stand up again. One of the Americans, a boy with a fat face, was crying and moaning softly as he reloaded his magazine. "No VC, no VC." They didn't look at us. They made us turn back around. They made us kneel back down in the water. When they started shooting, I felt my mother's body jumping on top of mine. It kept jumping for a long time, and then everywhere was the sound of helicopters, louder and louder, like they were all coming down to land, and everything was dark and wet and warm and sweet. The circle had gone quiet. My mother came out from the kitchen, squatted behind my father, and looped her arms around his neck. This was a minor breach of the rules. "Heavens," she said, "don't you men have anything better to talk about?" After a short silence, someone snorted, saying loudly, "You win, Tun. You really did have it bad." And then everyone, including my father, burst out laughing. I joined in unsurely. They clinked glasses and made toasts using words I didn't understand. Maybe he didn't tell it exactly that way. Maybe I'm filling in the gaps. But you're not under oath when writing a eulogy, and this is close enough. My father grew up in the province of Quangai, in the village of Sungmi, in the hamlet of Dugung, later known to the Americans as My Lai. He was 14 years old. Cheers.
Thank you so much. That is a really stunning story, and he only read part of it, but I think one of the things that is so fascinating about that story is that it's really about storytelling and about what stories can and cannot do. And so I want to start out our discussion by asking that question, what can stories do and what can they not do? You know, in the beginning of the story, we see that character struggling to write. I particularly appreciated how little he had accomplished in his year at Iowa. It made me feel better about myself. So thank you for that. And then he ends up writing the story that he, you know, sort of lampoons in the beginning, talking about all the, you know, the details about the food and all that. The friend says, you know, that's what all those stories are full of, details of food. And you can get away with that with a story about, you know, immigrants or foreigners. And of course, he ends up doing that. And so the story really works on so many levels. It's a story about a father and a son. It's a story about history, but it's also a story about what stories can and cannot achieve. And so I want to start talking about that and ask you a little bit about that, what you think of that question.
Sure. Well, thanks for a soft pitch as an easy starter. I was thinking about this the other day, and it seems... It's difficult in retrospect to think about, in a sense, what binds the stories together in the book, just because I didn't write the book thinking that it would be a book. I just wrote the stories and never expected them to get, you know, lumped together like that. But the one thing which sort of occurred to me was that in every single one of the stories, there seems to be some sort of struggling against the fact that language is always inadequate, that the stories always fail to capture and articulate experience and reality and truth and the fullness and the resonance of what we actually feel and live every day. And in many of these situations, language is both the curse and also the vehicle by which the curse is communicated. And these people don't know that because that's all they have. Mm-hmm. And so I feel very strongly that from one point of view, to write a story is, if you're doing it in good faith, is to acknowledge the bankruptcy and futility of actually carrying it through, certainly through to any point that's commensurate with what your original hopes and expectations might have been. But by the same token, it's somehow heroic, I think, and noble to keep on going when you know that... that you're not going to get there. And it's somehow enlivening to me to really care in the face of a certainty of failure, in a sense, and to care about gradations and to care about why this cadence works in this sentence and why that one doesn't, to care about why this feels more real or authentic or meant than something else, even though we acknowledge that none of it actually gets us there in the end. Mm-hmm. And so I guess the answer is that... good stories that I love, they're open and they do things accidentally almost. They do things because they're open to negative capability and to mystery and to leaving some sort of space where the reader can, you know, chuck in their own energy and create something which is different in every case. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are exceptions to that, and there are writers who seem to just know exactly where they want the energy to go. But I find personally that, you know, the stories that I love are the ones that show immense rigor and yet a complete elasticity at the same time.
Well, I think this story is a perfect example of that, because on the one hand, it feels very natural. It feels almost like a memoir. You know, I mean, the fact that you made the first character into Nam, whether or not it is autobiographical or not, we have a sense as we're reading the story that it has a memoir-like quality. Is it really fiction or not? Is it true? Did it happen to him? It really begs all those questions. But at the same time, when you finish the story, you realize the structure is so complex and sneakily complex, and that what the truth of the story is has kind of snuck up on you unawares. And I think that's one of the things that, as a writer, certainly for me, and I imagine for you, it's, you know, when you are surprised by your own story, the reader is surprised. And when you're not in complete control of what it is, you know, you've let loose this kind of fast train and you're not quite sure where it's heading. I think the reader has the same experience in reading it, that they're not quite sure and they think it's one thing and then it becomes another. And I think that's really profoundly true in this story. One of my favorite lines in that story that you actually read was when the father says, and I'm paraphrasing badly, he says, "I read your story about the boat people," and then he turns to the homeless man and he says, "We are boat people." And that is such a that question of what is real and what is fictional is really pervasive throughout Nam's collection. So many of the stories in the collection have to do with historical event. There's a story about Hiroshima. There's a story that takes place in the drug wars in Colombia. There's a story that is about the boat people, obviously, the title story. It really also asks the question, well, what can a story do to history that is different from history? What, why, and I guess it's part of the same question, but maybe a little more broad in terms of why not just write nonfiction? Why not tell the story about a real boat person who came over? Those stories are going to be dramatic in and of themselves. What does fiction do that makes those stories, in my mind, more powerful than reality? So maybe you can talk a little bit about why you chose the different situations that you chose, the different historical moments that you chose for these stories, and talk about why you made that choice.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because in the course of research for a lot of these stories and just general reading, I continually sort of bang up against the reality to me that, in fact, often, you know, nonfiction or personal memoir or personal testimony or oral history is so much more charged and powerful to me. Like when I was researching the My Lai thing, you know, I'm reading these transcripts from the court-martial and different lieutenants that were given immunity, you know, testifying against Kelly. And just that simple declaratory exchange, you know, knowing what you know with all of the history and all of the context, it's so incredibly powerful to me. And there's no art to it. It's completely blunt and it's completely exposed, you know. And I think, ironically, that's what makes fiction so attractive and powerful to me as well, is that it's all artifice, it's all contrivance, it's all arrangement and choreography, you know, when you deal with words. When you deal with words, you automatically deal with alienation from the thing itself, because language is not the thing itself. And fiction, to me, is more honest in a strange way, because it sort of just throws it up there and says, look, I'm made up, I'm artifice, I'm an artifact, so make of me what you will. But I don't claim necessarily to draw my strength or authenticity from the outside world, you know. And ideally, I believe, and this is certainly not the way that we read or judge things, but I believe that a work of fiction should be able to make the case for its own existence, purely within the confines of its own space. Mm-hmm. And a work of fiction should be given the opportunity to argue for its own acquittal, both in an evidentiary sense, a rhetorical sense, a philosophical sense, based purely on the words on the page. And so I find that, the wanky thing to say would be that fiction can actually get into the interstices and corners, can, with great latitude, burrow into people's consciousnesses, which history or non-fiction can't, according to the current precepts, really do. But I think it goes beyond that. I think that fiction is self-empowered by its own freedom, by its own acknowledgement of failure, of not getting to the thing itself,
and by its own made-upness, its own contrivance. And those are the things which, when they really hit and they strike a chord in you, can move you so much more deeply than the real-life stories that we read.
Mm-hmm. I also think that it allows us to, you know, when you read something that's wonderful and you cross that line between knowing something is real and knowing something's fictional, and yet there's a kind of murkiness there, and you feel that what you're reading is real. And I think that we crave that experience. I think that, I mean, it's why obviously stories have been so, to me, you know, they're prevalent from the beginning of history. I mean, obviously there's something in us that craves to move beyond reality, you know, that we want to have that experience, whether it's in dreaming or whether it's in reading fiction or whether it's in listening to music or looking at a piece of art. But there's something in us that wants to leave reality and yet not entirely. And I think fiction creates that experience for us, good fiction, because so often you'll read a book and you'll say it felt real. Or you'll say it didn't feel real to me and I didn't like it. And so there's something existential about that need that we have to cross that line, you know, to have that dreamy moment, to be suspended between what's real and what's not real. And I think that works of art that are fiction can create that for us, and that's why we crave them so much. But can you talk a little bit about why you chose, I mean, you do choose for many of these stories, not all of them, but really specific historical moments or specific social, you know, milieus, like the Cartagena story. Can you talk about what drew you to particular stories? For instance, start with the Cartagena story, I think.
Yeah, not with much credibility or authority, I think, that I can...
You mean you're not a...
I can make it up.
...drug lord and...
Right. I don't like to talk about that time in my life, okay, Marissa. Well.
I asked him if there was anything he didn't want to talk about before this, and he said no, so feel free.
It's inexplicable often, you know, how you just what you do is you chase the charge in a sense, and often things start squatting in your head. They take up real estate, and you really need to evict them before you can go on to thinking about the next thing. And so that story was one of those things where I'd read about these kids in Colombia. And the amazing line for me, and this story was interesting because it started out of an idea, which is unusual for the stories that I've written. But I'd read in an NGO report this line where one of these kids was being interviewed, and he was an assassin. You know, he was hired by one of the drug lords to dispose of the enemies, and the kid obviously felt some sort of condescension from the interviewer, and so at one point he says, you know, I am not a child, you know, I am a man. And the kid was 11 years old. And that was really, it just hit something in me because I didn't know what to make of it. Because on the one hand, of course you're a child, you know. But on the other hand, how or where do you get the standing to look into that world and that situation and that life and what that life has been through and make any sort of judgment call at all, you know. It's that precise space where I feel completely unfooted that was really interesting to me. And so I started thinking about this kid in my head and just thought, you know, here was a guy that was completely uneducated, completely illiterate, and had this very, very interesting, compelling, high-stakes story, and yet didn't have the opportunity or the dignity or the eloquence to tell that story. And so there was an idea in my head, I guess, that this story or that this situation required a voice. And of course the voice is completely made up. The voice is one that's cobbled together from various conventions and various mm-hmm. manipulations of conventions. But I guess the underlying impulse in that story was then to give this guy a sort of eloquence and dignity that wasn't at all condescending, but at the same time wasn't, you know, buying into the self mythopoeic grandeur, you know, of his own mm-hmm. of his own life. And so that was that story, and other stories sort of happen in different ways.
You know, it was in the beginning of that story, and I don't know if it was a misreading, but I actually wasn't sure how old they were, you know. And when you're talking about he considered himself a man, I mean, so much of that story is about this lost childhood in the sense that, you know, this child has no childhood. because of what's gone on. I think what's really magical about these stories is that even though some of them are set in these very moments in history or moments in societal moments that have a lot of weight. You know, we all know about Hiroshima. We all know about the drug wars. But yet the stories sort of transcend their space and they become stories on their own. They become intimate stories. You never feel like that you're reading someone's research, that you're, you know, which oftentimes happens, I think, when an author goes far afield from him or her, and I'm assuming many of these are far afield, you feel like you're a little bit sort of entrenched in their research. But I think what is so brilliant about Nam's stories is that he really, that all becomes very much peripheral, and the human heart of the stories becomes what's really profound. I think of that in terms of Hiroshima as well, that the story is, you know, about something that we all know so much about that we could maybe tell that story ourselves in a certain way, but he manages to make the history and the background very much the background, and the story becomes so specific that it really doesn't bear the weight of the history. Did you struggle with that at all, or was that something that just came naturally to you?
Well, thanks for, you know, that means a lot to me. I struggled with it a bunch, you know, it was really tough, and an interesting exercise from an outside point of view writing the story as well, because as soon as you invoke the word Hiroshima, then you invoke a whole universe of extant material and testimony and knowledge and films and documentary and fictional and non-fictional accounts. You know, you invoke a very, very visceral response that we all have, and a very potent stereotype of what Hiroshima represents. And it was really hard, because I knew that this was a story in which I wouldn't have a clean slate. I mean, I guess we never have a clean slate, really, but this was a particularly messy slate. Mm-hmm. And I guess the overriding tendency in that story was, when I was doing the research, actually it was meant to be a third-person story. It was going to have a few different characters. It was going to straddle both before and after. And, of course, all of the loaded material happens after the bomb is dropped, and all of the emotional punchy stuff you would imagine would happen after the dropping of the bomb. But it eventually just, it felt somewhat conventional, and it felt somewhat incommensurate with the weight of the material for me. And so in the end, I made a decision to not do anything after the dropping of the bomb. And then, going back to what we were saying before about language, I decided to, it felt truest putting it in the very immediate consciousness of a young girl, a young child, who was the very manifestation of the tragedy that she didn't have the language to understand or speak about what she was going through, and that what she was going through on a linguistic level and on a sort of psychological level would be what we would call brainwashing, because she was just being pumped full of patriotic slogans. And yet that doesn't render that landscape of her mind any less true or real or clear, and any less beautiful, in a way. And so I guess I wanted to get that tragedy across, the pathos of her mind being completely architectured by these willfully misleading words and signs and ideas, and yet have, again, some sort of dignity and some sort of truth in the portrayal of that. And so I guess the tragedy there is one that I'm piggybacking on everyone's, like all my readers' immediate responses to Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. And then I guess instead of building something up, I'm trying, hopefully, to muck around with those feelings and to re-channel them or marshal them into this particular consciousness.
So how much of that is conscious in your process? Or do you feel like it's, I mean, sometimes when we talk about things after the fact, we're very eloquent about how we came to things, how much of that is, do you feel is conscious, or how much do you trip on things and...
I think it's just negative relief, isn't it? It's you try something and it doesn't work, and you try something else and it sort of feels good, and you know, your ego gets sort of pumped up, but it doesn't work. It's not true. It's not organic to the thing itself that you're trying to get across. And then when you find that that note, you know, that chord, then you just keep on, you hold on to it, you strum it, and you watch it as it moves and as it decays, in a sense. And I guess that's, it's really difficult to explain what that thing is actually is. But in one way, I think it really is just a relinquishment of ego, you know, and getting rid of all the things that you actually like, all the things that that speak well of you in a very vicarious way, and to try somehow to put yourself in the service of that consciousness and that particular truth.
A lot of people have asked, you know, how far afield is a writer allowed to write, you know, from themselves, and it's certainly something that you've gone very far afield. So did you ever have moments of feeling inauthentic or feeling that you didn't really have a right, or a right is kind of a, I mean, I don't agree with that, but that you weren't really the person to write that voice? Did you have those sorts of struggles, or did it come fairly easily to you?
I absolutely had those struggles. And I mean, and then I struggle with the struggle, because I struggle with the notion of, like what you were saying, the right to write, and the notion of authenticity, the notion of authority, the idea that a work should or can be judged based on precepts or principles outside of the work itself, like we were talking about. But also the idea that if you write about something that is a bit alien to what I knew would be my audience, then somehow that becomes representative or ambassadorial. Somehow it assumes some greater signifying significance. And I dispute that as well. You know, I try to refute that as much as I can. And so in the stories, I guess I don't want to screw it up, you know. So I'll do as much work as I can, and read whatever I can, and watch whatever I can, and talk to people and stuff. But at no point do I want the onus of historical accuracy. At no point do I make the choice if a sentence requires that a thing be one way, but my research shows that it was the other way. At no point do I want to feel a fidelity to the truth, so to speak, because my truth is not to that. My fidelity is to something else. And so I struggle with the idea of, can I write about this? But from one point of view, I feel as though exactly at the moment when you think, oh, can I really get away with this? Exactly at the moment when you think, I don't really know enough about this. Exactly at the moment when you think, oh, this is revealing too much of myself, or it's too hard or whatever. I feel as though those are the moments that actually carry, for some reason, and you're very intuitive about where the good stuff is in your own heart. That's where the good stuff is, I think. And if you just keep on pressing into that wound, you know, you might find some good stuff.
Absolutely. And I think that it's, I mean, I think there's a, you know, a body of thought of, you know, who's allowed to write certain stories. You know, can African-American people write white stories? Can white people write African-American stories? All those sorts of things. And, I mean, it becomes very politically charged at a certain point, especially if you're writing a story about a group of people, like you said, about Cartagena, people who actually don't have a literary voice in the States. Maybe, you know, maybe they do in Colombia. There's all sorts of, you know, political issues around that. But I think what's really powerfully true about your stories is that they're really, you get so to the heart of what it means to exist that it doesn't really have anything to do on some level with who, where, what, why. It's really about existence, and this kind of universal is a tacky word to use, but I mean, it really feels like you're so deeply inside these characters and so deeply inside their sensory existence that it doesn't have anything to do with the world in a funny way that you choose to write about. There's one thing I wanted to, and I want to talk a little bit about this idea of how to convey the self and how to convey existence. I mean, I think for me, you know, one of the greatest challenges of writing is how to really convey character in an accurate, in a way where, I mean, you can never convey a person, obviously. You're, you know, we can't know each other even on real terms, so to know one another in fiction. But I think part of the fiction, the art of fiction, is to sort of find those gestures or bits of behavior or pieces of language that somehow explode in the mind and do create a person. And you do that sort of story after story with such incredible finesse and with such a variety of characters. So I really want to talk a little bit about how you do that. I don't know whether if you can talk about it in any kind of technical way, and I know I would hate to be asked this question, but I'm going to ask it to you. So, you know, how do you approach character?
Oh, boy.
I knew he wouldn't like it.
No, it's a good one. How do I approach character? I guess the first thing to say would be that I would never approach it in isolation, and that all the elements of a story need to work in concert with each other, and that there's always a sort of homeostatic mechanism when you're writing, when you think, well, if I do this, then that'll require like an infusion of that, and if I do this, then that's going to draw a lot of attention and energy to this, and so therefore I need to somehow counterbalance that with that somewhere, and the this and that could be the length of a sentence, or it could be the placement of a scene, or it could be the telling of something in retrospect or in the moment, you know. I think the one of the things that I struggle with is the idea of how to give some sort of truth or fidelity to what I imagine a consciousness might be like, and yet not somehow pass judgment on it, or somehow elevate it or belittle it, or somehow even cast it as other. And I think that that's the rub, in a sense, is to try to not ventriloquize or channel a character, but somehow to find those mysteries or those moments, those spaces of instability in a character that yet affect instant recognition. And so what you're saying, I really love what you're saying about like moments or gestures that explode in the mind, because I think the most precise and accurate moments of characterization are precisely those which aren't precise, which aren't specific, or which can't be pinpointed to one thing. And they open up because they allow a space of interpretation and a space of very, very muddled identification on the part of the reader. So the reader will think, I can sort of understand this, I can sort of see what's happening, maybe I identify with it, but at the same time it's pushing me away because I'm recognizing it as something else. Mm-hmm. That's not me.
Yeah, there's a in the story in Tehran, which is a story about a woman who comes from, where is she living in the States? I forget.
In Portland.
In Portland, to visit an old college friend who's Iranian and has gone back to Iran to be part of a feminist movement. I don't want to make mistakes. And this American woman comes having left a bad love relationship, and she's coming. And it's really about a woman sort of very much stranger in a strange land. She's put herself in a completely alien environment, and it's very profoundly what we're talking about, because she's struggling to figure out who she is in a place where she's stripped herself essentially of everything. And I picked this quote out because it seems like something that's true of many of Nam's stories, is they're really about this very essential but very inchoate idea of what it is to experience, what it is to exist and experience moment by moment what's in the world. The woman, having lost herself and her bearings in this completely alien environment, steps back and remembers to be inside herself. She says, there was no incongruity at all, or maybe everything was incongruous. Maybe that was the condition of things. She was thinking of their drive here, how everything would seem like the grimy, industrial, urban standard, when suddenly she'd glimpse the yearning, tapering spire, the delicate axis of an arch, and for a moment she'd remember to exist alongside the ghosts of this ancient city. I think that that's something that Nam gets at a lot in his stories, where characters had these moments where they come together with what it means to exist. I think that, and it's such an essential thing that we all experience. You know, you go through a day and you forget to look at the color of the sky. You go through the day, you forget to be inside your life. And I think what these stories do so marvelously is they have these transcendent moments where characters suddenly have these moments of connecting with what it means to be and what it means to exist in the space. And oftentimes it happens because of these very dramatic situations that they've put themselves into or been put into, whether they're in a Vietnamese boat person, or whether they're a woman who's gone to Tehran knowing nothing about it. I think these dislocations cause people to suddenly have these moments where they suddenly feel what it is to be. And is that something that you worked on, or is it just accidental? Or
to go back to, if I can piggyback to the last question, I think that's one of the guiding principles within which I work, is when it comes to character, there's no such thing as inconsistency. And I really reckon that if you were to posit one attribute or moment or thought or behavior to a character, and then you thought of the complete diametric opposite thing, you know, that not only would it be possible that a character would contain those two tendencies or impulses or behaviors or thoughts, but that it's almost inevitable. And I really believe that we are all capable of everything, and that we work under the misapprehension that we know each other and that we know ourselves, like you were saying. And so it's almost like a get out of jail free card, mm-hmm. in a sense, because as long as you go with the con and go with it with full conviction and sort of make-believe authority, then you can make a character say or think or do anything, and then make them say or think or do anything else at all, and there will automatically be a line of truth linking those two things, and then it's your job as a writer to find that line of truth, right. or to find something that will make that universe coherent, mm-hmm. or credible.
Well, I think each one of these stories has that moment where out of this stew of behavior and this stew of very confused action and confused ways of thinking, the characters really do have this moment where they collide with being alive. And I think that's what gives these stories just their incredible power. And Louise is waving because we're supposed to open it up to questions. Sorry.
No, it's beautiful. So
please, anybody have any questions for Nam?
Or Marissa,
but Nam. Anybody? No?
Please.
Yes. I think let me for the microphone so everybody can hear you.
At what point in time in your life did you make the transition from your homeland to your experience in Iowa and becoming a writer?
Well, I grew up in Australia, and I guess I'm always very not good at answering the when did you become a writer or decide to become a writer thing, because I really don't know what that means, to be honest. And in some ways, I reckon that that we should open that door to whoever wants to walk through it. And for me personally, you know, if you write, then you're a writer, in a sense. But I mainly read and wrote poetry up until a few years ago, and then I was working full time as a lawyer and disliked that a little bit, and so. I went traveling for a year, and during that year, I decided to give a novel, give fiction a go, and try to write a novel. And because I thought that's what one did, and one, you know, wrote a novel and made a lot of money, became a writer, got film optioned, and then, you know, would be able to burn their suits. So I wrote that novel, 700 pages, and then it took me 4 years to, you know, realize it was really bad and had to throw it away. But I guess that's the point at which I came to Iowa and wrote these stories in opposition to the novel, because I was so in hate with that novel that I just wanted to write anything else at all. And so that's partly the reason why these stories sort of bounce around so much, because I just didn't want to stay in one place at that time.
You know, they're called stories, actually, though not on the cover of the book, but I think it's really, they're more... to me, stories have a kind of different sort of compression. These are really fictions, and there are, some of them are so expansive, and I don't simply mean in length. I mean in the breadth of what they manage to cover, that they really have the texture of novel. I mean, you really feel like you're the movement of them and the shape of them, they really have... there's something in between stories and novels, I think.
I could have sold them as 7 novels, maybe. And
yeah, well, then you would have had all that money and
that's
all those
right.
film options.
That's right.
And, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I guess piggybacking on that, because I see you get uncomfortable when, you know, the questions are much more personal, and yet you chose to name the character in the first story Nam, and obviously I'm sure every single time you're interviewed people say, is that your story? Is that your... So, I mean, I have that issue myself because I write very far from myself. Almost nothing that I write has anything to do with the particulars of my life. And yet you sort of begged the issue. So what has your experience been with that?
As we've been talking about, you know, the stories sort of range a little bit. And if you do read those stories, then you'll very quickly realize how resistant I am and allergic I am to that sort of self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. And I guess in that story, it was just absurdly uncomfortable for me, because not only was the character named after me and had some of my situations, he was, you know, a writer, struggling writer in an MFA program, and that
Iowa.
MFA program,
yeah.
You know, and he was a bit of a dickhead to his girlfriend, and had, you know, troubles with alcoholism, and had the stereotypical abusive father, had, the really, really cliched tropes of the one story typed on a typewriter that was burned in the only burning gasoline drum in the whole town sort of thing. I mean, just ridiculous. And so I think the only way I could sort of square that with myself was when I was writing this story, I was so resistant to every single one of those things. And like we were talking about before, that seemed to me a sign that I just had to go there. I couldn't protect myself in that sense, because then that would somehow very, very minorly, you know, affect the actual trajectory of the story and where it needed to go.
Did you ever try writing it about George Lee, or, you know, did you ever not have it be Nam?
Yep, I tried that. And I tried it not being at Iowa. I tried making it the deadline, you know, for a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried a whole bunch of things. But I think, you know, part of the story is a provocation. And it's not a provocation just to readers, but it was to myself as well. It was sort of like a dare mm-hmm. every second. Like, are you really going to do that? Are you really going to have him, you know, say this or do this? And I think...
But has it exposed you in a way that you don't like to be exposed? I mean, do you feel like people think they know you even though they don't?
Yeah, I mean, people do read it. A lot of people do read it as straight memoir. Mm-hmm. And
I find that people read a lot of times fiction as straight memoir too.
Yep.
And
yep.
That, you know, I think that's, again, going back to what we were talking about, that the line between fiction and reality is that, you know, when you write something that has that such a visceral sense of being true, people assume that it is, and that you must have experienced it, or, you know, some part of your life must be bound up in it. And you know, oftentimes that is true, I think, for writers, but oftentimes it really isn't at all.
Right.
But I think it's one of the sort of, it's a pitfall, but it also comes out of having done something, you know, powerful and true.
Well, I think that's interesting, because in one way, I think memoir is almost by definition less honest than fiction.
As we know from some
right.
specific.
because, you know, when I had my wisdom teeth pulled out the other day,
How can you remember?
I mean, yeah. when you write a memoir, I think you cannot, I truly believe this, I don't think Shakespeare could have written a memoir without in some way being conscious of the impulse or the thought, what will people think of me when I write this or do this.
Well, and also the desire to make story is so strong, and to make things have a shape. And we do it when we tell our kids stories at bedtime, you know.
Right.
We make up a story about a knight on a shining armor, but it has a shape. But life doesn't generally have a shape. It's only in the retrospect that we give it shape. And so I think that's, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Does anybody else have any questions? Here we are. Oh, see what we provoked?
Oh, here we go. It's all fiction.
Oh, okay, it's all fiction. So you were never in any of the places that you wrote about? You just researched and looked at videos, films, read articles, and made it all up?
It's a tough question to answer, because, for example, I did go to Colombia, and I was in Cartagena, although I wasn't in Medellin, where the story took place. But, I mean, I hope it's not facetious to say, but... there's no way that I could have been to those places, even if I had been to those geographical locations, you know, because the Tehran that woman saw at that particular point in her life, at that particular time in history, and within the emotional and psychological matrix of her life, was completely, and would have been completely rightly, light years away from my own subjectivity. And place within fiction cannot be separated from the subjectivity which views that place, you know, and the things which we see as being necessary or sufficient
to render a place differ from person to person, and actually differ within a person from time to time as well. And so you can never capture the essence of a place. And I never try to do that. I try to get one essence, and that's the essence that I'm trying to somehow concretize in the story. So I've been to some of the places, some of the countries that are, you know, the characters have been, and some of them I haven't. But you know, even if I'd wanted to go to Hiroshima, it would have been quite different now than going on August 6, 45.
David?
You shared a little bit about the disadvantages and the advantages of being a writer of Vietnamese descent. I was wondering if you'd just touch on the notion of being an Australian writer and what that means, and whether you've maybe transcended that by the Iowa experience and these fellowships and whatnot. And then secondly, just to touch on the great success of these short stories and then going on to write a novel, and I guess the stories written maybe in Iowa with input and support around that, and then being launched on your own with some profile to write a novel, and the expectations and dealing with that.
You dirty dog. hang on, what was it, the first question? Oh, Australia. Marissa, do you want to answer that one?
Yes, well, after I left Australia.
No, I think it's bloody interesting because Australia is a country that accepts and rejects, to varying extents, influences from all over the place. And it's set in Asia. It's weaned from the teat of ye olde England. It has a very European bent in, you know, its intellectual life of the last few decades. And, of course, now America is a formidable influence, cultural and everything else as well. And so I think Australians, along with many countries that are not America, I think, deal with that question of how much emphasis do we or should we put on establishing an identity, establishing a national narrative, establishing some sort of foothold that's outside of what's out there and what's big. And I don't think there are any real answers to this. I mean, I think you could sort of refight the cultural wars of the 70s and talk about various ideas of Australian nationalism, mainly through political lenses. And I think a lot of people are doing that and are still doing that in literary journals in Australia today. But I also think that it's become much more acceptable to be considered Australian or to have a narrative considered as Australian, with fewer of the connecting indicia actually present. So if you think about one of those weird tests where, you know, in order to become a citizen of a country, you need to speak the language, to spend X number of days or time to have an ancestry or lineage that goes, you know, according to a certain thingo. If you think about that with regard to Australian literature, I think fewer of those boxes need to be checked now in order for the literature to be considered Australian. And then that begs the question, what is Australian literature? Why is it important that that literature be called Australian or not? And that's a bigger question, I guess. But I always find, just to throw it out there, that it seems really strange that not only in work but in day-to-day designation, the first thing that we sort of stick in front of someone's name is where they're from, what country they were born in. And of course that's really telling in many regards, but you would think that there are many contexts in which there might be another adjective or another, designation that's actually a bit more relevant. And so I think that falls prey to the same, you know, inertia. And I think we have no time for your second question.
Anybody else?
Your writing seems to be very organic to me in the sense that it's a harmonic more with an emotion than an intellect. Do you monitor your writing? Do you select a meter or a voice to appeal more to have burst in someone's mind an emotion more than understanding from an intellectual point of view, is how important is it that you connect with a person's emotions, regardless of what reality is?
Right. That's a really, you know, perspicacious point. I was reading a thing by Thomas De Quincey on murder, actually, just the other day, and there's a bit in it where he talks about how sort of poverty-stricken the notion of understanding is, and the notion of actually calibrating our thoughts and actions via understanding. And the analogy that he draws is that of perspective. He says, you know, unless someone's been trained in draftsmanship or perspective, if you were to ask a layperson to draw a streetscape from, you know, the second floor window of a building, then most of them would actually not be able to square, forgive the pun, the idea that right angles aren't right angles, and that, you know, that's what our understanding, our rational understanding, leads us to believe. But of course, the actual apprehension, and this is something we see 24 hours a day, or when we're not sleeping, I guess, we see the skewedness of perspective all the time, and yet we cannot really bring ourselves to understand it in more than a very conscious and rational way. And so I think what you're saying really appeals to me and moves me, because you need to, I reckon, distrust so many of your faculties when you're dealing with creating something that is completely invented. And the impulse is always to grab as many points of commonality as possible, because language, all it is a code of commonality in a sense, and you want to sort of pull in all of these expectations and assumptions. But in fact, in order to get it right, you almost need to unlearn all of that and then do exactly what you're saying. You need to find the chord, you need to find the cadence, you need to find, you know, whatever rhythm or inflection might actually signify a particular consciousness, and then you need to have the stupidity, I guess, to just follow it through.
A good note to end on. Thank you all for coming so much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.